Hey, Dilemma fans. I had a bit of a technical issue this week, and it's a boring story, but unfortunately, you will not be hearing the sultry tones of Coleman Hughes on this episode. It is actually just going to be me and this featured guest, Sean Carroll, in our uncut conversation. I promise you, Coleman and I will be back with our terrible jokes and wonderful rapport next week. So this is episode number 7 of Dilemma, and it's called Religion at the Hospital. The dilemma itself is really simple. It's basically a guy named Steve is on his deathbed at a hospital, and his nurse is named Betsy, and she is an evangelical Christian who believes that you have to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior in order to get the reward of eternal paradise. And she has every reason to believe that Steve is an atheist, and the dilemma is she wants to convert him and proselytize to him. So you're about to hear Sean, who is a pretty well-known atheist who's been speaking about these issues for a long time, and myself engage in this conversation. So again, apologize for the technical problems. You'll hear me and Coleman again next week, but this week it's me and Sean Carroll. So enjoy episode 7 of Dilemma. Okay, so thank you, Sean Carroll, for being on Dilemma.
Thanks for having me.
So this one feels fairly straightforward. It's a nurse who is clearly a Christian and a patient who appears not to be. Where do you start to break this one down as far as a moral dilemma goes?
Well, I'm personally not a religious believer. I'm an atheist. Some of my best friends, as they say, are religious believers. So I certainly have no trouble with getting along, you know. And I think it's a very interesting question. Actually, I don't think it's straightforward at all, because what I tend to think is that if I were truly a religious believer in the old school fire and brimstone sense, and if I really believed that I could save someone's eternal soul by converting them to my religion, then I think that there would be nothing more important in the world than doing that, right? And by those lights, the right moral thing to do would be to spend all of your effort, all of the time in front of any obstacle, trying to make people believe that that's what you have to do to get into heaven.
Yeah, I tend to, from her perspective, it seems I totally get her reasoning. If true, I don't care what rule is there. This is the ultimate stakes here for her patient Steve.
That's right, but Of course it has to be multiplied by the fact that you might not be right in your religious belief, right?
So, and that brings me to so to talk a little bit about your work as a theoretical physicist, which is, you know, on this podcast we have moral psychologists, we have moral philosophers, we have some people more in the hard sciences. And you've written a lot of great books that are about specifically, and I want you to talk about poetic naturalism and sort of what that means, but about how we talk about things and mm-hmm. how many different kinds of talking about the same thing can be true. You, if I'm getting it wrong, you don't dive head first into like how we talk about things morally, but you don't skirt it. So with that, with you just laid it on the table, like if true,
right?
You're hinting at, is there a truth there to be known? In this sense,
I think there's a couple of things. One is, I do think that there's a truth there to be known about whether or not God exists. You know, so I think that there's what we would call ontological questions. You know, what is the fundamental stuff of being? What is the universe made out of? Naturalism is the idea that it's just the natural world. There is no supernatural world. There's nothing over and above the natural world. Physicalism is a little bit more narrow than naturalism. It's a version of naturalism that says the only kinds of stuff in the natural world are physical objects or whatever physics eventually teaches us. Quantum mechanics might be different than classical mechanics that way. So you can actually be a naturalist but not be a physicalist if you're someone like David Chalmers, mm-hmm. who thinks that there are mental properties that material objects have. Okay, anyway, I would go beyond that to say that the things that are true and false about the universe in the conventional sense of true and false are the natural world physical kinds of things. You know, where is the stuff? What is it doing? How much does it weigh? Where is it going to go? That kind of thing. Whereas things like moral questions or aesthetic questions are things that we can talk about, these judgment questions, but they don't inhere objectively in the fabric of reality in the same way mm-hmm. that the physical questions do. We can disagree with one another about these moral questions, and that doesn't mean that there's any experiment or any logical demonstration that proves one of us right or wrong at the end of the day.
Hmm. Does that put you in the relativist camp in a moral sense? Do you find yourself paralyzed to make something close to an objective moral judgment? Clearly, well, you think Betsy's wrong here.
Yeah,
I think she has a wrong answer.
Like, that's right. I think that her final answer is wrong, even if her reasoning is right, because her premises are wrong. Mm. So the label that I attach to myself is moral constructivist.
Okay.
And Sharon Street, who is a professor at NYU, a moral philosopher, is one who I get a lot of my favorite points of view about this from. And there's a difference between a constructivist and a relativist. A relativist says that morality just comes from your context. It's relative to, you know, what society you live in, or whatever, and therefore, maybe you could argue that people who are not in that context, people who are outside that society or whatever, have no right to pass moral judgments on the people inside. So a constructivist doesn't say that. I think that's silly. I think it's completely silly. And I think this is a crucially important point, because I think a lot of people who are naturalists want to be moral realists, morally objective, just because they want to be able to pass judgment on other people. I mean, what's the fun of living if you can't pass judgment on other people, right?
Yeah.
So a constructivist admits that moral judgments are not facts out there in the world, like dinosaurs once ruled the earth or the universe is expanding. They're not things that you can subject to scientific investigation that way. But that doesn't mean that you're powerless. That doesn't mean you can't make moral judgments. We construct our moral theories. We construct them from a variety of things, from our, you know, biology, our training, our reading, our rationality, our cognitive insight. But once we construct them, we can use them. We can say, no, that's wrong. And it's not wrong in the same objective way as it would be to say the universe is contracting rather than expanding, but that doesn't stop you from saying that it's wrong. It's not a quietist point of view of morality whatsoever.
Hmm. I'm going to try to push on this a little bit. In Betsy's case in particular, is there a moral failing, or is there just a factual error that she's making, and are they different? And by that I mean, I'm with you at this moment with Steve dying in front of her and her facing this, all of these conflicting things in her head. She's doing what is eminently moral in her calculus. But can I rewind the clock somewhere? I guess the question that I'm really asking as a constructionist is there a moral duty or obligation to construct it using the evidence of the universe?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there is something about being right about the facts that also matters, right? If you delude yourself into thinking that killing a million people, you know, placing a bomb in a big city is a moral good because, you know, if you die in a bomb attack, you go to heaven, and if you don't, you don't, then you're still culpable, right? You're still, you know, responsible for that tragedy that you just caused. Even if the moral part of your reasoning is completely okay, the sort of rational fact-based part of your reasoning, which also comes into it, was completely wacky. And I think that kind of critique is perfectly okay to level at fundamentalist religious people.
So like, I guess I'm struggling then, like, where does the word moral and morality, in this view, is everybody acting morally because in their own mind they've constructed it? So does this word sort of just disappear into the ether, where morality is actually just sort of a bit of a myth, a way of talking about something?
There's plenty of people who know perfectly well that what they're doing is not moral.
Okay.
Right? And I think that, you know, we often struggle with moral things, not just because we don't know what the right thing is, but because there's other influences that, you know, are against us doing the right thing. You know, maybe we know that we should give a little more money to charity, or maybe we should, you know, help the person on the street or whatever. There's many, many times. So I think that making strong moral judgments is not in any sense just a matter of labeling whatever we do as the morally right thing. There's a whole room for moral philosophy in the sense that, you know, we have these impulses, we have these feelings about what is moral and what is not. And so let's take these feelings and let us reason about them. Let us figure out, you know, is there a system that we can fit them into? Like, what about these edge cases? What about trolley problems or moral dilemmas, right? Which are the hard problems. We generally get our moral intuitions based on the easy problems. Killing babies is bad, right? Then can you build that up into something which would also do well for the harder problems? And that's not a hard thing to do, which, like, moral philosophy is contentful.
So is there to take a utilitarian stab at it, are there facts about flourishing and suffering to be discovered in a way that, let's say in this case, I think you and I would probably agree, and maybe we should dig into it, that Betsy, maybe inadvertently here, but because she happens to be wrong about a fact of the universe, and maybe we should actually just tackle that to like, because we're kind of glossing
over. We can do that too.
But, how bad God of an explanation is, right? Yes. We'll table that for now, but we'll get to it. But assuming she's making a factual mistake, is that leading to a moral mistake, or let's say an objective moral failing? Because I would argue that the flourishing is not being maximized here in this particular situation, and suffering might be. This is Steve on his deathbed trying to hope, presumably end his life peacefully, and getting harassed by this woman preaching this crazy idea at him. Can I say I'm with you that in her mind she's constructed something that's perfectly moral, and but has it objectively in a utilitarian calculus? If there are facts to be discovered about flourishing and suffering, I could say that the situation is a moral less than ideal. There's a moral failing here happening, and I would trace it back to Betsy's failure to construct her morality in a way that is demanded by the universe. I don't know. I'm often
well. I mean, I think there certainly can be facts about flourishing that we discover scientifically and that can come into our moral calculations. I don't think it has anything especially to do with whether or not you're a utilitarian or not. I think that even if you were, some sort of deontologist who said that there's certain rules that you should obey, and those rules make you want to, make people happy in the right circumstances, then knowing what makes people happy is a very important piece of data. Nobody in their right minds denies that facts about the world are relevant to moral reasoning, right? Like, that's just a straw man. The question is whether or not facts about the world determine moral reasoning entirely, or is there something else that comes into it? So I think that in the case of Betsy, right? Her mistake is an incorrect view about the world, if that's what it is. But I don't see it as a moral failing at all after that. I do honestly think, not just cynically trying to say, by the way, I think that honestly, if that were the world that we lived in, then her actions would be completely moral.
Yeah. So then to stick on it, because I'm not asking my question well enough. I agree with everything you just said, but is there a no one has to be in this universe, here we are in this mysterious thing, Betsy has not done the work of truly investigating her ideological claims about the universe and the after universe in her case. If you agree with that statement, is that the failing? Do we all have a duty to investigate our beliefs?
Well, I would say insofar as the actions we take based on those beliefs affect other people, right? So the example of, blowing up a city because you think that, there are people who legitimately believe that life is suffering and they're utilitarians, and therefore they think that the more people you kill, the better you're doing for the world, right? And that's a morally coherent point of view. It's not mine. I would argue against it. I hope that not too many people have it. But it's not a logical mistake given the axiom that, life is suffering and you want to minimize suffering, right? So, and I think that the same thing is true for Betsy. And so I think that in either case where you're bombing a city or whether you're converting a patient, you should recognize that you are making decisions about other people based on your view of the world. And in that case, yes, I think there's sort of a moral duty to make sure your view of the world is as accurate as possible. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit less of a duty if it's only yourself that you're harming. Mm.
Is it self-harm to have a wrong idea about the universe? I mean, I'm sure I'm walking around with ideas about the universe that are wrong and that I haven't investigated. As long as I keep them to myself, this is fine.
I mean, it's complicated because I think that, of course, everyone has wrong ideas about the universe. Right. Yeah. So it would be nice if our ideas were as close to the reality of the universe as we could get. But to say that it's a moral wrong, I think, is too strong. I mean, I think you'd have to be a little bit careful about that. I mean, certainly some of the incorrect ideas we have about the world are very useful. You know, they get us through the day, right? When you study neuroscience, for example, you learn that we don't go through the world being these perfectly rational, reasoning creatures. We have heuristics. We have shortcuts. We have rules of thumb. And there's a good reason why. You know, they get us through the day. They were evolutionarily selected for. They use fewer brain power than if at every red light you had to stop and think, there's a red light. I wonder what that means. Let me recall what the rules about this are, right? And these rules of thumb are usually right, but sometimes wrong, and that's the price we pay. It's a little increase in efficiency compensated by a decrease in accuracy, right? Is that a moral failing? You know, I don't necessarily think so. So overall, I would say that, yeah, sure, being accurate about the world is better than being inaccurate, but there are trade-offs there. And so I think it'd be too glib to just say it's a moral failure to be wrong about the world sometimes.
Okay. Let's just tackle it then with her. Why is she wrong? Let's just do like we'll do the obvious one in case there are people in doubt. Why is she wrong about this?
So I'm someone who believes that science does have something to say about the existence of God or not, right? I know there's a popular point of view that says that it's just a non-scientific question or you should be agnostic about it. How would you ever know? But that's clearly not the kind of reasoning you use for a million other analogous questions, right? You know, Russell's teapot. If there's some teapot floating in outer space, that would look weird to us. We don't know that it's not true, but we have good reasons to believe that it's not true. So we construct not just a set of individual beliefs about the world, but a whole system of beliefs that fits together really, really well. And science is part of that system of beliefs. And knowing as much as we know now about the natural world and how it works, most of the originally perfectly reasonable justifications for believing in God and the supernatural have gone away. You know, we have better explanations for the world that we see around us. So that leaves us with other reasons to be religious or to contemplate being religious, having to do with, you know, a sense of community and morality and things like that. But I think that once you get rid of the reasons for this ontological move to say there's a whole supernatural realm that is very, very ill-defined and, you know, it's very different for different people in different parts of the world, then rather than saying, well, yes, but we still need it for morality, the better thing to do is to say, well, okay, let's do the hard work of constructing morality on the basis of a purely naturalist view of the world.
Is there a concrete example that you could give of that, of like a fact in the universe that points or seem, or say it the way you think it makes more sense, that points towards a moral sort of, this is the is-ought kind of David Hume challenge, or does it whittle away oughts that just are eliminated by facts of the universe that can be found?
No, I think that there is no bridging the gap between is and ought. I think that that's just there. It's just a logical fact. And, you know, I know that people want to get around it. And those are exactly the people that Hume made fun of. And he's still making fun of them from beyond the grave. And it's more a matter of therapy, right? To just accept that you can't go from is to ought. And therefore, what are you going to do about it, right? And I think the reality is that part of the is who we are, you know, who we are as human beings at the end of a long chain of evolution. Not the end, hopefully, but at the present moment in the long chain of evolution, we're born with certain impulses, certain instincts, certain preferences. And then, as we said, you can change those preferences and instincts, right? You can think about them. You can reason and try to do better. And on the basis of those, you try to build up a moral system. And different people might have different moral systems. And, you know, the entirety of, you know, meta-ethics, in my view, is saying, and that's okay, because that's what's real. That's the best you can do. So I'm not about trying to overcome the is-ought problem. I'm about dealing with reality, that we are all a bunch of individuals with different impulses, but happily not entirely different, right? There's a lot of overlap between what people want. There's a lot of room for reasoning both individually and together to make the world a more moral place.
Can I try with the is-ought thing?
You can try.
I might be one of those people who stubbornly thinks there must be a bridge because I really want to walk over it.
So he makes but by the way, you really want to walk over it, which is, of course, a blatant admission of a cognitive bias.
This is motivated reasoning that you can then tear apart. But I think I'm going to try to point to my illegitimate move that I know is a cheat.
The good thing is you're not alone.
I know. Oh, no, I've got a lot of friends. This bridge is crowded. It's overcrowded. But I'm going to point to where I know it's a cheat. But I could skip some of the early parts of the deep dive into it. But you said something about sort of the best we can do, which is almost the way that I try to get around it, or I try to tackle it, or try to fight Hume to go to this ought from the is, in almost this Carl Sagan way. His beautiful poem and poetic sort of observation, which was that we are a way for the universe to know itself. It sounds like poetry is as beautiful as poetry, but yep. Really, when you think about it, it's a hard scientific observation of just noticing this moment and the situation that we're in. And you smuggle in all the mystery of consciousness, and that sentence never changes. I'm with you, and I'm with Hume, but there is no ought there. Just because we are a way for it to know itself, there's no commandment to know itself. But I find that whittles away everything else of that it's the only game in town. And the only thing that I could point to by doing that scientific kind of onboarding of a Sagan observation is you saying blowing up a city, or like, why shouldn't we just kill everyone on Earth, or why shouldn't we just end the universe? Well, that would be a violation if there were some just one big cosmic commandment. It'd be the only game in town is for the universe to know itself. I guess you could talk about this as a universe reaching its self-awareness potential in some sort of almost Deepak-y sort of language. But I think something in there holds where it is an is that can only point to an ought, even if it's a very, very broad ought. But it at least gets me so far to, I think, or I'm trying to convince myself, I know, and I know that's the illegitimate move, of that indiscriminate murder is a violation of this commandment, because if there is only one, you are now certainly decreasing the potential of the universe for it to know itself, which is the only game in town. So it's the only thing to do here is to do that. I mean, your work as a theoretical physicist is all about embodying that sentence, I think. Did so I do it?
Just admit it. Just be honest. You're making a very clear is yes. statement, right? Yeah. That we are self-aware, conscious creatures. There's no moral commandment there nope. whatsoever. Now, you're saying that suggests to you that that's a good thing, that we are aware
just
of the universe.
Thing. It's a thing.
No, you're suggesting it's a good thing.
It would be a good thing to not abandon that.
There you go. Okay. So that's an entirely separate statement yeah. that you're axiomatizing. Mm-hmm. You're putting it forward as a foundational principle for moral reasoning. Just admit it.
Yeah, but I think it's a good one.
It might be a good one, but you didn't derive it from what is. You're suggesting it, but which is fine.
I admit it.
It's okay.
I fully admit it. Good. But if the is was that we were incapable of making sense of the universe, then would that point to a different ought? Because we have this mysterious ability to make sense of the universe, make predictions, and put the puzzle pieces together just a little bit.
It's perfectly easy to say we are the universe's way of knowing itself, mm-hmm. and that kind of knowledge is a terrible, horrible thing, and we should work to eliminate it. That is a completely really? Coherent moral point of view. It's
right.
a different one than yours, and I'm not in favor of it, yeah. but it is just as logically compatible with what we know about the universe as yours. So if we're going to get morality off the ground, we have to make some choices that are not grounded in facts about the universe.
Okay.
And that's okay.
I agree it's okay. And I, you know, if that's the first one to start with, I think it gets you in pretty good places. I guess.
This is a major frustration for we moral constructivists, because of course, once you admit the reality that you can't derive ought from is, because it's just logically impossible, and we're in favor of logic, the hard work begins. It's not the end, right? Like now we can have the interesting conversation about, okay, what should we construct, mm-hmm. right? Like that's the productive, interesting conversation that everyone should be having, but instead, we're all stuck with people who just won't give up on deriving ought from is, and that's very frustrating.
I'm going to try not to give up one more time.
Okay,
we'll go
there you go.
But in the universe A that gives up, as in the universe A is the universe that was, I guess, the latter version of it saying there's no moral commandment that we ought to know the universe, or the universe ought to know itself.
I mean, that's not so the universe. That's a separate moral possibility, right?
There's right.
A potential moral axiom that says we should try to know the universe. That's a good thing. There's a separate moral axiom that says, no, knowing the universe is bad and we should try to minimize that. So these are just two different competing theories. The same universe, though.
But if I could do the experiment of a universe A where everybody's convinced of one extreme and universe B where everybody's convinced of the opposite extreme, so universe A would be one of all Carl Sagan's and convinced that this is a the good thing to do, if good means anything, is to try to maximize this knowing, however cosmically you want that to mean, versus universe B, meaning we should just all kill ourselves and end this, because that's actually what this commandment means, is that we should all know nothing, meaning we should all cease to exist. I'm going to say feels. Universe A feels like the more moral universe than the universe B that doesn't exist. In that sense, and again, it can be. I'm trying to borrow your language.
Because
it's the best
you
we can
like
do.
It. Because you like the idea of people knowing the universe and living and surviving and flourishing. I like it too. I'm in favor of it, but I'm just slightly self-aware enough to know that I didn't derive it from facts in telescopes or microscopes. Yeah. I just like it. You find that if you go through all these arguments and erase the idea that there is something objectively out there in the world about these judgments, about aesthetics and morality, the arguments don't change. They're perfectly good without them, and they're much more intellectually respectable.
Yeah. All right. No, I'm rather convinced by you. I guess I do. I'm always searching for that firmer ground to stand on that separates you from the...
It's very liberating to give up on it.
Yeah. But and the constructionism is great. I mean, I've given up on it. I've always given up on it. But I guess the language that I always use is like, can I draw a straight line from the universe to a value?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I get the attraction. Yeah. Like, I was there. I definitely used to believe exactly this way. Yeah. And boy, it would be nice. It would be nice to sort of axiomatize or empiricize judgment in the same way that we do with science. It just fails. It fails like it's one of those things where like once you admit that it fails, you're like, oh, obviously. Like, how did I ever even think this?
Yeah.
And you just get on with your life and it's fine.
But certain people do seem to make the mistake because it fails. They think they're too the domains never intersect and never talk to each other, which is just a mistake of the religious of like, oh, science can't answer questions of morality, but some people say can't even inform them.
That's right. So I think, and this is a little bit more contentious, but I would go so far as to say a lot of the reason why naturalists want to cling to some objective notion of morality or meaning or aesthetics is because they haven't completely overcome religion. Mm-hmm. They're trained by the example of religion to say that there's no real meaning or no real morality unless it's objectively grounded in something that's absolutely firm, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fact that the firm thing is science, not God, is a much shorter leap to make than the leap that, oh, there isn't a firm thing, right? And they don't want to make that leap, and it's scary, and it seems to like be giving up, be ceding ground to their enemies. And it's very motivated reasoning, and I think that it's going to be hard to overcome it, and so that's why we're fighting. To say that a moral conclusion is bad is just not the same as to say that I incorrectly derived it from facts about the universe. Like, of course we all do have moral inclinations, and our moral inclinations are more or less pointing in the same direction, right? We want people to be happy, we want them to be nice to each other, we want them to flourish and all those things, and the devil's in the details and getting all those things exactly right. So to argue that, well, if I chose this particular moral axiom, then those things wouldn't happen, is begging the question, you know, it's saying, well, I've already assumed that those things happening is what I want, right? Mm. But if I didn't want those, I wouldn't want them. It's sort of axiomatic. So again, by all means, let's argue about how to best come up with a moral system where we can know the universe and flourish and talk to each other and be happy. But let's not pretend to base it on facts about the universe, empirical facts. I think that does an incredible disservice. You're making the same mistake that Betsy made.
So why is she, I guess we never fully answered why she's wrong
And I guess you're right in this case about God being a bad explanation for the universe.
Yeah, you know, I think that when you start trying to understand how the universe works, your job is to say, you know, under my potential understanding, I predict what the universe should look like, and then I compare it to what the universe does look like, right? That's the sort of Bayesian reasoning that I talk about in The Big Picture. Mm-hmm. And if there were really a God who created the universe and in some sense cared deeply about human beings, and that sense includes the idea that God judges us and, you know, either rewards us with eternal paradise or condemns us to hell forever afterward. Number one, I don't want to live in that world. And that's not an argument against it, but let me note parenthetically that I don't want to live there. But number two, that world seems like it would be remarkably different from the world we actually live in. Like, why in the world is God so cagey? Why in the world is God so difficult to understand? Mm-hmm. Like, given this momentous decision, why is it that there are a million different religions that have different opinions about how to get this eternal reward, right? This just makes no sense from an empirical try to understand the world point of view. So that's the mistake of people who have this absolutist view of what is right and wrong based on some feeling about ontology, some feeling about how the world works, is that if their ontology is just not a very good fit to the world, then I think that they can be held responsible for their morally bad actions.
Hmm. So is that trying to match an ought to the is? It's almost the other way?
Well, it's I think that the reasoning that actually leads you to do things in the world necessarily will always involve both ought questions and is questions. So I don't think that Betsy's mistake is in the ought part of things. Like we said, if she were right, then that kind of action would be perfectly understandable. But she's mixed up the is questions about the world pretty badly.
Yeah. So to get to some more of the stuff you wrote about in The Big Picture, to see how, if this relates to morality, because that's sort of the nature of all these questions. I failed at my first run at it with the way to talking about things, about the, if I'm getting it wrong, it's something like you could talk about a blade of grass at a zoomed in quark level, and it would be just as valid as saying a blade of grass and just as valid as saying something incredibly poetic about this thing almost on a qualia level. That's perfectly fair.
There's many ways of talking about, you know, the blades of grass in terms of its atoms or its wave function or the cells inside or its grassiness or whatever.
Yeah.
But these are all descriptive ways, right? These are all scientific, you know, here's what is happening in the world kinds of ways of talking. And when you're in that realm, you have this wonderful feature that you can test your ideas against the data, against observations, against experience. You can go look to see which ideas are right and which ideas are wrong. There's a whole other set of ways of talking that are not tied down that way. You can say, oh, this blade of grass is beautiful. And someone else says, no, it's not, it's ugly. There's no experiment that shows that one of those people is right and one of them is wrong. The one person says, you know, I think it would be good to let that blade of grass live as it is a living creature. And another person says, well, it's just a plant. It's, you know, there's millions of these things just lying around. It would be absolutely no moral problem whatsoever to pluck that blade of grass. That's not something you're going to adjudicate by doing experiments. So that's a different kind of question. So there are multiple ways of talking that might not have the same rightness or wrongness in an objective sense as the scientific description does. But the point of poetic naturalism is we can still talk that way. You know, there's nothing incorrect any more than there's anything correct about the person who says we cannot pluck the blade of grass. It's just something to which the same notions of correct and incorrect that would apply to the more straightforwardly scientific questions aren't relevant.
Hmm. So to zoom back in on the particular dilemma, as we could wrap it up, sort of getting to Betsy and Steve.
Yeah.
Let's just start with you, Sean. How do you approach this? I don't know who I could put you in the position of, the hospital director or something. You find out Betsy, under your employ, is behaving this way. You just fire her immediately, or try to convince her of her wrongdoing, or you're saying, well, what she's doing is moral in her own mind, so I've got no leg to stand on here.
You know, if she refuses to go along with the hospital rules, then yeah, you can fire her. You know, I mean, like, good for her. She's sacrificing for what she thinks to be the greater good. But we live in a society. We live in a world where people have incompatible beliefs at a fundamental level. And I think, you know, that's, again, a whole nother thing that this attempt to derive ought from is thing distracts us from. In the real world, it's not just a matter of finding the right moral way of thinking and making sure everyone does it. That's never going to be the world in which we live. In the real world, people are going to have different values and getting along in the world despite the fact that we have different values. That's the interesting question. That's the tough one. That's the real world question we have to deal with. And part of it is, part of the way that we actually do that in the real world is to say, you know, your individual beliefs about morality can go so far, but we have rules. We have playing nice together rules. And if your individual beliefs about morality get in the way of those playing nice together rules, then too bad for you. And that might be, you know, your job as a nurse or doctor in a hospital. It might also be your obligation to, you know, vaccinate your kids or something like that, mm-hmm. right? We say, look, you live in a society, the society has rules, and you're able to go a certain distance with your personal creed, but there's a place where that stops, and you have to obey the rules.
Yeah. Maybe this is too much of a political question, but I wonder, you as an atheist and as a vocal and prominent atheist, how often you get proselytized to or people trying to convince you of whatnot. And then I wonder also in this moment where if you rewound the clock, I don't know how long your public career has been, probably 20 years or so now you've been sort of doing this, even longer.
Yeah.
The chart of people who are self-identifying as atheists or agnostics has certainly like increased.
Right.
But I think there's suddenly a big notice of like, are they really atheists as in like embracing full-on critical thinking and scientific reasoning, or is it going this far? And now it seems that there's a bit of a curiosity again or a wonderment about, oh, if we've lost this part of society's rules that at one time were religious and helped people get along, I guess I just have to like put that out there. Do we have to replace that with something, or are we lacking something? People, I don't want to call them out by name, but Jordan Peterson is attracting quite a crowd talking about religion in different ways. And then it seems to be some noises, maybe as a pushback of atheism, or just wondering if we're really making a mistake. I know that was a lot to throw at.
No, I think this is exactly the important set of questions. And this is why, you know, I had a little workshop that I organized a few years ago called Moving Naturalism Forward. Mm. Because, you know, it's easy to say that God doesn't exist. That's not the hard part, right? That's not the real work intellectually. The real work is, okay, God doesn't exist, so what are you going to do about it? How are we going to live together? What does it mean to be moral? And I think that a lot of my fellow atheists and naturalists are, you know, dropping the ball, mm-hmm. whether or not it's because they're just ignoring these questions or whether or not they're seeking overly simplistic answers, yes. like deriving odd from is. And I think that, you know, the living together, the value alignment questions, the what does it mean to be good, you know, utilitarianism versus deontology versus virtue ethics, end of life care, mm-hmm. you know, all sorts of important questions are hard questions, but tackleable questions we can make progress on, and, you know, what we do from a day-to-day basis kind of questions, right? Like, you know, where does the meaning come from in our everyday existence? And I think that, you know, the existing literature on the meaning of life is just terrible. It's just, you know, very, very bad. There's some individual moments of brilliance, mm-hmm. but it's not serious. It's not very applicable. It ignores to a tremendous extent most people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. If you read about the meaning of life, you're probably reading something from some academic or some spiritual person, and they're going to talk about, you know, creativity and being true to yourself and, you know, art and music and things like that. And most people want to, you know, watch movies and go to football games and, you know, earn a living and have a job and have a family. And where are all those things, right? So I think that we've done a terrible job at adjusting the discourse of society to the fact that God doesn't exist. And I wish that that's where my fellow atheists were putting a lot more of their efforts.
Yeah, no, that's exactly why I'm trying to do this show. I hope I'm not making the is-ought mistake. So then to put it or I'm admitting my mistake and why I'm having this own explanation or exploration for myself of like, I want to do this better and know how to do this better. Really apply philosophy in some ways is sort of just in the ivory tower a little bit easy. Applied philosophy is really,
yeah,
really,
you know,
hard, but it's the fun word.
There's all these studies showing that ethical philosophers are no more ethical than people on the street, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, there's and that's telling, because I think there's enormous value in ethical and moral philosophy, but the application is a different thing,
yeah.
right? You know, like, you know, physicists are not great pool players, even though we know the laws of Newtonian mechanics,
that's
right?
Yeah.
The application of the rules is a different thing than knowing what the rules are. And that's okay. You know, that's good. We live in a world where there's many different skills and many different skills that are important to have. And so I think that ultimately, to be perfectly ethical or moral, moral philosophy is crucially, crucially important. Mm-hmm. It's still possible as an empirical matter to be an expert at our current state of the art and still a terrible, terrible person. Yeah.
So then on that practical level, what if you, we all know Betsy, we all know a million people like Betsy, she's not rare. What do you feel for someone like that? Do you feel an obligation to, do you think they're missing something and missing an experience in the universe because they're holding these beliefs? And do you, I'm talking about your everyday now, yeah. how we as atheists or as these kinds of thinkers move about our life. Do you feel an urge to like proselytize to them or unproselytize or whatever word you would use there to like,
I think, yeah, know? When it comes to trying to change people's minds,
yeah.
My first question is always, where are their minds right now, right? Mm-hmm. There are people whose minds are made up. You know, like my mind is made up about plenty of things. You know, in principle, mm-hmm. I'm open to anything. But in practice, again, to get through the day, I'm not going to waste my time on a bunch of ideas I think are wrong, right? Yeah. There are other things where I truly don't know what the right answer is, and yeah. I'm extremely open-minded. Everyone is like that. So I'm going to concentrate my efforts not on the most fundamentalist evangelical believers that the universe is 6,000 years old. I'm going to concentrate my efforts on people who say, well, I don't know. Like, I haven't really thought about it. You know, let's talk about it. And in that case, I'm very, very happy to talk about it and try to see, you know, why I believe what I believe.
Yeah. It's because if this was flipped, let's say Betsy's dying and you're the nurse and you're rather convinced that she's wrong about this belief, would you try to, on her deathbed, you know, to totally flip the roles here, convince her that she's wrong so she could die without this mistaken delusion about the universe in her head?
Well, we haven't actually talked about what I think people should do when other people are dying, right? You know, I think that what Betsy is doing is wrong for the reasons that we talked about. But if you're a naturalist and you think that death is just the end, right? I don't think there's necessarily anything bad about dying with some incorrect ideas in your head. We're all going to do that. You know, let's face it, right?
I'm younger than you.
So I do, right? Well, okay, you can be hopeful that none of your incorrect ideas last that long. But I'm coming more and more, the more I study moral philosophy, the more I think about it, the less of a utilitarian I am. Mm. I think that it's better to think that there's sort of a right way to live and behave. And there's all sorts of semi-obvious dilemmas you get into if you're a real utilitarian. And I think that people worry about them. And I think the answer is don't be utilitarian. Yeah. And when it comes to the right way of living when people are dying, you know, I'm going to put the needs and wants of the dying person before anything else. Mm-hmm. If Betsy wants to be told that Jesus loves her, I see no problem with telling her that just before she dies.
Really? You would do that, yeah.
I mean, why not? I mean, she's the one who's dying. Like, who the hell am I to try to, like, lay down my view of the universe when this person is literally breathing some of their last breaths? Yeah. That just seems like an incredibly petty and tiny way to go through life.
I'm totally. How much could I rewind the calendar to where you would be okay with that? Let's say she just gets diagnosed with something. She's got 2 years. Is that, like...
Well, look, even someone right now, even if someone who's young and has many decades in front of them, if they're utterly uninterested in talking about these things and being persuaded about them, then I have no interest in trying, you know? I do sometimes talk to audiences of primarily religious people, and it's a very similar experience I have when I talk to physics audiences, namely that the young people are willing to listen to me. The older people have made up their minds. And, you know, maybe that's how it is. Like, maybe that's completely okay. But I think that there's plenty of young people who are religious, who believe in God and think that's an important part of their life, but haven't really thought things through yet. And if you give them an alternative and you present it in a friendly, open, non-confrontational way, here we are all, we're on the same side, we're trying to understand how the world works, many people will start thinking about other options. And I would much rather do it that way than get into a shouting match with someone who's already made up their mind.
That's the work that excites me as an atheist and a secularist is always attributed to Gandhi. I'm sure he never said it, but be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah.
Cliche hallmark, but actually a really good quote, I think, to sort of onboard. And for atheists, what good is it just making fun of Betsy all day? If you really want to show her that that's not the recipe to fulfillment and the good life and flourishing and however you're going to define it, well, go ahead and prove it by flourishing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, living, giving advice is easy. Living is hard.
That's really good. That's probably the best place to end it, because that's this entire show is about giving advice and then at the end saying we have no idea.
We have no idea. We're just watch what people do, not what they say. Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So hopefully you enjoyed that between Sean and myself. Next week, our next episode is with Rebecca Goldstein, and it is another episode that's pretty serious about death. It's called Friend Bot, and based on a situation where a woman tragically loses one of her best friends in a very sudden death, and creates a chatbot in his image using his data and using his patterns of texting and interaction in the digital world to kind of deal with her grief. And so Coleman is on that one, and Coleman and I talk about some pretty serious issues in that one. So I think I put this on social media recently, but we are entering the emo phase of Dilemma, where we're dealing with some really, really serious, heavy topics. So this is the good stuff. So strap in and enjoy. Take care.